afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you'd like to be on the program, we have a line open for you right now at 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to call and ask a question that you have about the Bible or some Christian theme, we can talk about those questions here, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host on something that's been discussed previously and would like to balance comment, feel free to do that. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And our first caller today is Tyler, calling from Tacoma, Washington. Tyler, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I'm a new listener, and I just started listening a few weeks ago. I have, like, about a dozen of your podcasts and trying to catch up with your live show. I wanted to start off by telling you that I really appreciate your ministry. There's a couple different Bible Answer guys that I listen to, and I just think I've never disagreed with something you said. So I just wanted to thank
you
for what you do.
That's great. You haven't been listening long enough.
I guess not.
Yeah.
I guess not. We'll see, though. We'll see. But I had a question about Acts 15, at the Jewish Council.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's kind of converted to Messianic Judaism, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
We were kind of debating over if Christians should be under the law of Moses, you know, and he brought up, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have a Bible with me right now, but
yeah.
He brought up the fact that they decided to abstain from idols and whatnot, and because James said that it was read in the synagogues every Sabbath. And so what he was saying was that that's because they decided to train the Gentile disciples in the law, starting off with those four. Could you, kind of clarify that for me?
Yeah, well, of course, the decision was made not to put the Gentiles under the laws of Moses, and the principal issue was the matter of circumcision. But the matter of circumcision was very significant in that if a Gentile was circumcised, it generally meant he was becoming a Jew. For centuries earlier, a Gentile had been permitted to become a Jew if they'd be circumcised. And what was being decided here at the Jerusalem Council is, does a person have to become a Jew in order to become a Christian? After all, the Messiah was the Jewish Messiah, and all the early disciples were Jews. And in fact, the first several thousand Christians were Jews, and now Gentiles were coming in, and they had not become Jews. So the question is, is the Jewish Messiah also for people who are not Jews? Now, if the Gentiles had gotten circumcised, it would not be controversial because they would thus have become Jews. And one could say then the Messiah is not just is for anybody who's circumcised, is for a Jew. But these were uncircumcised Gentiles, unconverted to Judaism. And yet they were Christians, and so there was some question as to whether this was permissible. The decision was made that they don't have to become Jews. They don't have to be circumcised. In fact, James said we don't want to put any other burden on them than a few things. Now, the few things were that they should not eat meat sacrificed to idols or things strangled or blood or commit fornication. And he said, because Moses has those who read him in the synagogues and have for many generations in every city. As I understand it, what James is saying is that the Gentiles historically have been very offensive to the Jews in some of their behaviors. Things like eating blood and living in rampant fornication, especially temple prostitution in the pagan temples. And eating meat sacrificed to idols and such. And he's saying, we don't want the Gentiles to be put under the law and become Jews, but we do want them to be circumspect about how their behavior could offend Jews, because there are Jewish people in every city, he said, who've had Moses preach to them from the law in the synagogues for many generations. That means in every city, in every Gentile city where these Gentiles are being converted, there are many Jews who have for generations been trained up in the sensitivities of the law of Moses. And they are offended by some of the gross things that Gentiles do. So let's please urge the Gentiles to avoid those things that offend the Jews. Now, I believe that that's the meaning James had in mind, because Paul seemed to say so himself when he said that, you know, he dealt after this time in 1 Corinthians with the question of eating meat sacrificed to idols. He actually said that, you know, it doesn't matter if you eat meat sacrificed to idols, because an idol isn't anything. But he said, if it offends your brother, then you shouldn't do it. And you also shouldn't compromise by going into the idol temples and eating feasts there, because then you're going, you know, you're basically acting like an idolater going into their temples and participating in their sacred feasts. But he said, if you eat meat that's sold in the marketplace, you don't have to even ask whether it's been sacrificed to idols or not, like a Jew would have to ask. But you just eat whatever you want to, because it doesn't matter. But he said, if it's going to offend somebody, then don't do it. And that was, I think, James's concern, too, that Gentiles, some of the things Gentiles eat would be offensive to the Jews around them. And I think James was concerned that the Gentiles not do the things that would offend their Jewish neighbors. There's no suggestion at all that they were expected to come under the law gradually. I mean, Paul made it very clear in Galatians that if the Gentiles would be circumcised, that put them under obligation to keep the whole law. And he said, if you're doing that, then you've fallen from grace and you're estranged from Christ. So Paul clearly didn't think that keeping the law was the obligation of Gentile Christians.
Well, thank you very much. That's very well explained, and I appreciate it.
Okay, Tyler, good to hear from you.
Yeah, I will. I'm sure I'll be calling. I have a whole list of questions at home. So.
Oh, great. Well, it'll be good to hear from you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, you too. Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, our next caller is Kyle from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Kyle, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Today my question is regarding, well, something A.W. Tozer brings up. I recently finished The Pursuit of God, and I've listened to a number of his lecture or sermons, which, you know, the recordings are free online. And the topic of Christian entertainment comes up, and he was very much against that concept. He felt it was heresy. I mean, he used that word. And I really respect him, and I'm tempted to agree with him, but I'm a little tentative. He almost seems prophetic in some of the things that we have today. But I don't know. I'm just kind of curious on your thoughts, too. I want to get another opinion of someone I respect.
Yeah, well, Tozer was prophetic, very much so. That doesn't mean everything he said was necessarily inspired. But it does mean that he was seeing things, I think, correctly as far as the trend in evangelicalism in his day. And that trend has continued beyond his day. He died in 1963, and since that time, things have gone further, even the same direction that he was concerned about. So he did seem prophetic, actually. Now, his concern about entertainment, as I understand it, because I've read just about everything he wrote, also, and heard over 100 of his sermons on tape over the years. But his concern about entertainment, I think, was this, that Christians are replacing worship with entertainment. I don't know that he was against all forms of entertainment in general, although he probably was not very much for it, because he was a man who spent almost all of his time just kind of in his closet with God, and he probably didn't have any attraction to things for mere entertainment at all. He was not actually an extremely sociable man. He was very much a man who wanted his time alone with God. And some of his relationships in his church suffered for that, including some of his family relationships. But anyway, his own, I think, tastes would have been, who needs entertainment at all? Now, he wrote on the subject of entertainment in one of his books, actually an editorial he wrote, where he indicated that he felt that a person's addiction to entertainment corresponds precisely with the emptiness of their own spiritual life. He felt like the more satisfaction you have inwardly, the less entertainment and diversion you seek to fill those voids from outward sources of entertainment. And I would have to agree with him about that. On the other hand, I don't know that all entertainment is wrong, not even all secular entertainment. If you go to an opera or a classical concert or something like that, if that's what turns you on, that's not what I would do for entertainment. But I don't see that. I don't see that anyone could condemn that as something below the dignity of a Christian, although I will say the early church took a pretty strong stand against going to the theater. But that's partly because the theater was so debauched, as some of our theaters are. I mean, some of our movies are. There are definitely things that a Christian should not do for entertainment because they aren't entertaining to someone who's a Christian. It should not be entertaining to watch people do things that are an abomination to God. You know, if you're on God's side, then you're not going to feel any differently than he does about those things. And the fact that many Americans go to theaters or listen to concerts or otherwise entertain themselves in ways that feature things that are offensive to God, and those Christians don't find those things offensive but rather find them entertaining, only speaks of how far removed the mentality of the Christians is from God's mentality. I think that's a sign of backsliddenness of the church. On the other hand, people who really do love God and really serve God may not see anything wrong with certain, devoting a certain small amount of time to diversion. Sometimes people have very stressful jobs, very stressful lives, and to sit around and converse with a friend about anything might be relaxing, even if it's not about some edifying topic. And yet, conversing with a friend is entertaining. To listen to music that soothes is entertaining also of a sort. It might be that sometimes just watching a TV show that doesn't have anything that a Christian should object to about it can be an innocent diversion. The more a person is just devoted to seeking God in the way that Tozer did, probably the less they will have any interest in entertainment. But it would be a mistake, I think, to say that all forms of entertainment are inappropriate. Because, frankly, when I was raising my kids, we didn't even, ever have a TV, and we didn't go out for entertainment because we found our children so entertaining. We just loved to watch our kids. But I won't deny it was entertainment, and it wasn't wrong. I didn't feel like it was ever wrong to be entertained by my children's antics when they were little and stuff. I thought they were far more entertaining than anything I would expect to find on television or in a movie. But the fact that that was entertaining didn't make me feel guilty that, uh-oh, I'm being unspiritual because I'm finding this entertaining. People can be legalistic. I don't feel that Tozer, generally speaking, was legalistic, but his own distaste for almost anything secular, and that is a personal distaste for it. Not saying that Christians can't work at a secular job or can't have secular conversations or whatever, but he just didn't seem to have any personal interest in things apart from sacred things. Which is wonderful. I mean, that's actually a wonderful thing. That would make him particularly, unsympathetic toward entertainment. I think his biggest concern was, though, entertainment in the church. That is, entertainment replacing worship and entertainment replacing discipleship. And that was a trend he complained about a great deal, about the songs in the church and the various films in the church and so forth that he thought were replacing real spiritual meat with pablum, But he also felt that an addiction to entertainment simply is a symptom of having a rather hollow spiritual life.
Two comments I'd like to make. One, in the foreword to the book, whoever wrote the foreword was mentioning that he would be on his knees, so to speak, for anything he did, and they said that even when he would read the works of Shakespeare,
yeah,
I suppose would be on some level entertaining, he'd be on his knees asking the Lord for insight. So I think everything in his life just sort of proceeded out of his relationship to the Lord, which I think should be true of any Christian.
Right. I mean, if you go to a movie, if you're the kind of person who goes to movies, you should be watching that movie through the lens of your Christian convictions. And there's nothing in life that you can't learn something from. Like you say, he did read Shakespeare on his knees, not because he worshipped Shakespeare, but because he wanted to understand from God's point of view. But reading Shakespeare is something that would be entertaining, And so I would think that a Christian who reads books for entertainment or listens to music for entertainment or watches a movie or television for entertainment, that person should be doing so with the mind of you know, that contributing to his ability to see those kinds of things through God's grid.
And the other comment I was going to make, I agree with you, by the way, was, I guess, in my life it's been difficult to wean myself. I've certainly come a long way from when I was first saved, but I mean, I still watch a lot of things that I'm feeling more and more convicted about as I walk. It's just, it's so hard to balance that with trying to fight a legalism, you know. I think you just need to have everything proceed out of faith and love for God and not looking at your, you know, neighbor or your brother. Because so many people in the church, it makes it difficult for me pursuing holiness and what I do and what I consume, you know, when everyone around me is pursuing, you know, what the world pursues and what my flesh wants to pursue, you know, which is movies and entertainment to a very large degree. So
I think you said something that's entirely my thoughts, too, and that is that you need to do everything simply out of your love for God. If your idea is that God is very legalistic and frowns on you having fun, then you won't be having any fun, or you'll be having fun and feeling guilty about it. But if you don't see God as somebody who frowns on fun, but who does, who you know, he wants us to enjoy life, but he wants us to put first things first and keep him central to everything and love him with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength and make all of our decisions based on that love for him, then, you know, I believe there are people who legitimately would see that they can go out and do something for fun and have God smile upon it at times. Now, unfortunately, we live in a culture that almost idolizes fun. And, you know, a person almost feels like life is empty unless they're out having fun. I don't do very many things just for fun myself. And my one of my children is continually asking me if I'm happy or not, because he likes to have more fun than I do. And that is to say, he likes to do more things for fun than I do. And he thinks I don't have any fun. But see, I enjoy my life more than he enjoys his, I think. And what I enjoy is the things I do, you know, with relation to God and with the king and the kingdom of God. I can't think of any things outside of those things that would be more fun or more enjoyable for me. But some people don't understand that. But there's nothing wrong with enjoying innocent things, including innocent entertainment, I think. And as far as legalism goes, Tozer himself said in one of his editorials, he said, you know, the rule you have to make for yourself is others may, I cannot. That is, if there's something God has convicted you about, maybe someone has been convicted that they shouldn't have a TV, or they shouldn't go to movies, or they shouldn't listen to secular music, or they shouldn't go to plays or something. Maybe they feel convicted about that. But that doesn't mean that no Christian should be able to do those things. The rule should be, if God has convicted me not to do it, then I cannot do it, though others may. That's up to, between them and God. And that's how to live a holy life without legalism. That's where you say, I have to obey God in what he tells me to do. It's none of my business what he tells someone else to do, and I'm not going to judge anyone else by those standards.
Yep, and I think Tozer was right on that.
Yep.
Well, thanks for your insights, Steve.
Okay, Kyle, good talking to you.
God bless.
God bless you. Bye now. All right, Pamela from Sweet Home, Oregon, you're next. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, how are you today, Steve?
Fine, thanks.
I'm not sure how to ask the question, but I think you'll probably understand. Basically, I've been seeking and trying to be open-minded, but reading as well. And I've been following a religious organization that talks about First Earth Age and that kind of a belief system. Do you know what I'm talking about?
You know, I don't think I do. What's the First Earth Age?
The story basically is, and it's the Bible being taught verse by verse, chapter by chapter, as if that means anything. I realize that anyone could say that. That a third of God's angels followed God, a third of God's angels didn't, and a third of God's angels followed the devil. So there was an earth age, and we were all here. And then, due to the fact that Satan rose up and all that happened,
They're talking about all this happening before Genesis 1-2.
Correct.
Yeah, that's the gap theory, yeah.
And it's called the gap theory.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, I don't think there's any support for it in Scripture, frankly. The gap theory actually does provide a scenario in which certain other things can be placed that might be otherwise hard to place. For example, the gap theory, of course, teaches that God created the heavens and the earth maybe billions of years ago, but that before he got around to doing the things in verse 2 of Genesis, Genesis 1-2, where it says the earth was formless and void, before that point, there was a whole history, an earlier age before the creation of Adam. And that the suggestion that such an age existed has provided for some people a time frame for the fall of Satan, a time frame for the dinosaurs existing, and things like that. And it also allows them to believe the earth is as old as most geologists think it is. And so there's a sense in which that gap theory functions to answer hard questions that are, with sort of a paradigm to stick them into. But just because you can create a paradigm and stick a lot of things into it doesn't mean that's the right paradigm or that those things belong in that paradigm. There might be additional paradigms that work just as well that don't include such a gap. I just don't believe there's any positive evidence for such a gap, and I think there's a negative evidence against it. And that is that if you look at Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11, God is giving the commandment about the Sabbath, and he says, "For in 6 days the Lord created the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And he rested on the seventh day." Now, the reason that's important is because he talks about a period of 6 days in which several things happened. One, he created the heavens and the earth and the sea, and also everything in them. So the creation of the heaven and the earth is within the same 6 days as the creation of everything else. The gap theory suggests that God created the heavens and the earth billions of years ago, and then, much more recently, started creating the other things that you read about in Genesis chapter 1. But Exodus 20 and verse 11 places all of that within 6 days' time and therefore doesn't seem to allow for such a gap.
I see. I totally get what you're saying and haven't made any decisions. But one of the other things that's talked about is that, and I think you might be able to answer the question better for me, is let's create man in our image. Does that mean the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost? Because what's being claimed by this particular belief is that we look like we did in the first Earth Age. Does that make sense?
Wait. We look like people did in the first Earth Age?
We were angels in our own image. I mean, we had an image that looked similar to our human image. And that when God said, "Let us create man in our image," he meant exactly that.
Well, I don't know what the ramifications of are that. The make us in our image, many Christians do think that the plural us is a reference to the Trinity. Others have other views about that. Others have other views about that. But whether it were or not, I'm not really sure what bearing it has on the issue of us having been angels previously. See, I don't believe that. I don't believe we were ever angels.
I see. It's very interesting to study, and I thank you for all your insight, and I do listen to you, and I like hearing your point of view, so that helps me a little bit.
Sure. Now, Pamela, let me ask you about this group you go to. Is it a group you've joined?
It's actually on television.
Oh, I see. Now, is this something that you've associated with in recent times, or have you been for many years?
I had never heard that the first sin was when Satan came down and impregnated Eve. So, of course, when I heard that, I was like, what? So I listened, and then they came up with the story of the Cainites and good versus evil. And so I started listening to him. I actually did, and found him to be quite interesting, but I know that doesn't mean truth.
Right. Well, the idea that Satan impregnated Eve is called the serpent seed doctrine, and it's a heretical doctrine.
It's all connected in the same belief system.
Yeah. It seems to me that some people on TV in order to distinguish themselves from all the others on TV, have to come up with very strange and sensational ideas, even if there's no basis for them. There is no basis for any of those ideas that you just mentioned in the Bible. And in fact,
he seems to think there is, but I realize what you're saying.
I know. I've heard those views defended. I've heard those views defended before.
Yes.
And I think that people have to twist the scriptures to defend them. The other thing about it is, I think it's a distraction from the true gospel and from the true responsibilities of the Christian life. I mean, it makes us become fascinated in a theoretical situation that may or may not have existed thousands of years ago, and it has nothing to do with what we're supposed to do right now. What we have to do right now is follow Jesus. And I think when Christians get distracted by this kind of thing, it's an impediment to their following Jesus. And besides which, I think these doctrines are false.
I understand. And I appreciate that. And I do listen to you. I haven't made any kind of discernment myself personally, but, you know, and I'm not looking for a fantastic story to follow just because it's fantastic. I just want to make sure that I search out everything without going astray, you know. And this particular thing also does not believe in the rapture, and I don't believe in the rapture. So it's complicated when you start looking into trying to listen to someone who you hope knows more than you.
Well,
so,
the best thing you can do, the best thing you do is study the scriptures really yourself and become so acquainted with them that you know how to evaluate in an instant when somebody says something that you're not familiar with and say, well, that's agreeable with scripture, that's not.
I see. Well, I'm not very good at that, but I appreciate listening to you and the time that you give. So,
right. But you can become better at it. You can become better at it if it becomes your priority. See, if it isn't a priority to you, then you'll be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine that comes along from a crafty preacher, whether that's me or someone on TV or someone else.
I wouldn't see it that way as much as I would see it's hard to understand the Hebrew, and this may sound like an excuse, but it is hard to sit down and read the Bible as if you were reading a book. To me, it is. I mean, it's...
Well, you don't have to read the Hebrew because you can get a good English translation, and the ideas that this teaching that you're talking about is getting... it doesn't come from a superior understanding of Hebrew, because the majority of Hebrew scholars would reject these ideas. It's not from the Hebrew this is coming. This is coming from somebody's linking together certain ideas a certain way. And the question of whether that's a correct linkage of ideas is the issue. Not, you know, the person who says that, you know, Satan had sex with Eve, that person's not reading the Hebrew more clearly than most Hebrew scholars. Most Hebrew scholars wouldn't see that in the Hebrew at all. It's rather that the teacher he may quote Hebrew words as if to give himself an air of respectability for his views, but it's not the Hebrew or the Greek text that's informing him. Because if it did, then all people who were scholars in Greek and Hebrew would agree with him, and none do.
I see. Well, I will take up your advice and start reading.
All right.
Have you ever heard of the Strong's Concordance?
Absolutely.
Is it a good thing?
An excellent thing, yes. But it's not. It's not the only thing. It's a good source of basic identification of Hebrew and English words from the English text of the King James Version. There are other resources that go into more detail on those things than the Strong's does. It's a beginning resource.
Well, that's good. I appreciate your help, and thank you for your time.
Okay, Pamela. God bless you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now. Oops. Okay, let's talk to Joe from Las Vegas, Nevada. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Ezekiel 34, verses 7 through 11, I'm just a little bit confused because of what pastors are saying to me, but do you see there in verse 29 it says, they shall no more be consumed with hunger. I'm wondering, why are they seeing it strictly as, you know, feeding off the Word of God instead of...
Well,
like, okay.
Okay, the chapter is a rebuke of the leaders of Israel who are likened to shepherds who are supposed to take care of sheep. And it's basically saying that the shepherds are not taking care of the sheep. The shepherds are taking care of themselves and neglecting the sheep. And the prophecy goes on to suggest that God himself is going to judge those shepherds and himself shepherd his flock. Now, the fulfillment of that is in Jesus. Jesus, I think, was alluding to this passage in John 10 when he said, I am the good shepherd of the sheep. And he's the one who comes in fulfillment of this prophecy to replace the evil shepherds, which were the leaders of Israel at the time. Now, among the things he said he will do was, of course, feed them and protect them from the predators and so forth.
Yeah.
And it says they will no longer be hungry or consumed with hunger. And I personally believe that this is talking about spiritual.
Okay.
Because Jesus did not come to guarantee that people who are physically hungry will never experience physical hunger anymore.
Right.
But he did say, he that eats of my body, he that eats this bread that I give him shall never hunger. And so I think that that's probably him connecting with this passage here. Now,
okay.
There's similar language, by the way, in Jeremiah chapter 3. And it says, in verse 16, it says, verse 15 and 16, Jeremiah 3:15 says, I will give you shepherds according to my heart who will feed you with knowledge and understanding. Notice the shepherds feed the flock, but with what? With knowledge and understanding. It's a spiritual thing. And so that's what I think Ezekiel's also talking about. Jeremiah and Ezekiel both have the same theme there.
Okay, just one more real fast. In verse 23 of the same chapter, It seems that he's saying that he's going to set up King David.
Yes. David is there a code name for the Messiah.
Oh, in the lineage. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Because the Messiah, God did not reveal in the Old Testament the real name of the Messiah, nor the real name of John the Baptist. But David was a type of the Messiah, and Elijah was a type of John the Baptist. So in speaking about the coming of John the Baptist, Malachi referred to him as Elijah. In speaking of the Messiah, Ezekiel 34 and also Ezekiel 37 and also Hosea chapter 3 refer to the Messiah as David. Not because it's the literal David, but because he's descended from David, and David is a type of him. So he's like the second David, just like John the Baptist is sort of a second Elijah.
Right.
He's called Elijah.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, Joe, good questions.
Okay. All right.
Bye now. All right, we'll talk next to John calling from Denver, Colorado. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Hello, Steve?
Yes.
Hi, this is John Nathan.
Hi, John.
Hi. First off, I just want to thank you for your book, Four Parallel Views, Book of Revelation. I used to be a dispensational premillennialist, and as soon as I came to a more amillennial viewpoint, your book just really helped me. It opened up a world for me to see, and it opened me up so spiritually, and I got to see so many different perspectives, and I'm being so much more spiritually fed from the Book of Revelation than I used to be. So
well,
I just want to thank
that's
you so
wonderful
much
to hear.
That.
That's wonderful to hear.
My question, though, is, in your four millennial views, you have amillennialism, premillennialism, and postmillennialism. I'm kind of wondering, where would the belief system of the emperors held by the Seventh-day Adventists fall into what category? Would it be considered premillennial or amillennial?
Yes.
Or is
yes.
It just
seventh
of its own?
Seventh-day Adventists have sort of a unique view of the millennium, and I would place it in the premillennial category. They believe the coming of Christ, I think, is before the millennium, but they have a very strange view of the millennium. They feel that during the millennium, the earth will be uninhabited, and that the only party on earth will be the devil himself, and that there will be no people there, and the earth will be desolate. And that for 1,000 years, the devil will wander around on a desolate, burned off, destroyed earth to view the results of his own influence. And I'm not sure where they get that, except that Ellen G. White must have taught it. But it's a strange doctrine because it doesn't fit with anything the Bible says on the subject.
Well, actually, I researched into it. I think Ellen White borrowed it, but I think it actually goes back a lot, back further to like almost a Rabbi Katina, who taught this, that just as the earth in 7 days was made, and, you know, on the seventh day God rested, so the earth shall for 6,000 years be inhabited, on the seventh day it shall be desolate, referring back to the land Sabbath of Leviticus 26. And there's actually a lot of scripture verses that actually can kind of, you know, formulate that view. In Jeremiah 4, verses 23-30, I behold the earth, and lo, was without form and void, and the heavens, they had no light, and beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens were fled. And Jeremiah 51, verse 48-49, Jeremiah 25, verse 30-33, the slain by the Lord lie dead, unburied worldwide. Isaiah 24, and different passages in Isaiah and Jeremiah that describe Babylon, the punishment of Edom, that they'll lie desolate, that their land will turn into burning pitch. And it's just,
I'm familiar with those passages, and as I understand it, those passages are all talking about judgments that occurred in ancient history. In Jeremiah 4, where it talks about the land being desolate and every bird had fled and so forth, I believe he's using imagery from Genesis 1 to describe the desolation that would come on the land of Judah as a result of the Babylonian overrunning them. Jeremiah's context is all about the Babylonian exile, about the Babylonian invasion. You know, we can take certain groups of verses, like two or three verses in a cluster, and take them out of their context and make them say any number of things. But I think the only way to correctly understand the prophet's meaning is to recognize how those statements fall within the context of what they're saying. And Jeremiah is predicting the destruction of Babylon. It's true there are Isaiah and Jeremiah and others also talk about the fall of Babylon and talk about the fall of Edom. And in my opinion, they are talking there about events that all actually happened hundreds of years before Christ.
But do you think, though, that it was considered so distinct enough belief that this is not entirely premillennial, since there is no earthly rule of Christ on earth, and it's not entirely amillennial, and that there is a future thousand-year period and two resurrections that it would probably...
Your voice is very garbled. Your voice is very garbled. Do you have a bad phone connection?
I think we might be getting a storm coming through here.
Yeah, I can't even hardly understand you now, but I did hear your question. I think let me go ahead and answer your call off the air, because I think your phone is not intelligible.
All right. Well, thank you for the time, though.
Yeah, thanks for your call. The reason that I say that the Seventh-day Adventist position is a form of premillennialism, even though you're right, it doesn't have a reign of Christ on earth, is that the whole issue of whether we call something premillennialism or postmillennialism or amillennialism has to do with where do they place the 1,000 years mentioned in Revelation 20 in connection with the second coming of Christ. And I believe that the Seventh-day Adventists have the ultimate coming of Christ before the millennium. Though I could be wrong about that. I've read their views, and their views are very confusing. I don't think they really have much value on that subject, but nonetheless, I think they place the millennium after the coming of Christ, and in so doing, make themselves premillennial, because premillennial means believing in a premillennial return of Christ. But the Seventh-day Adventists have had more than one view about the coming of Christ throughout their history, and I have not really been able to keep up with their present viewpoint. So as far as the exact designation of their viewpoint, it may be just a matter of labeling, just a matter of semantics, to say whether it's amillennial or premillennial. But I believe that technically it's a premillennial viewpoint. Let's talk to Joe from Portland, Oregon next. Hi, Joe. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. My question has to do, would you contrast for me and in Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, give to every man that asks. If he wants your cloak, give him your tunic too, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In Acts, where the early church gave everything they had for everybody's use for a while, and even to their detriment, because they all became somewhat poverty-stricken in time. And that too, the parable of the 10 virgins, where when the 5 ask for oil, the other 5 say, no, we won't have enough for ourselves. I was just kind of reading through that, and that's what struck me, and I wondered what your opinion of that was.
Okay, well, first of all, the parable of the 5 virgins is not describing, first of all, the Christian duty of sharing their possessions. The having of oil or not having of oil in that parable speaks of being prepared or unprepared for a long wait. The bridesmaids, the virgins, have gone out to wait for the bridegroom, and their duty is to be alert in case he comes in the middle of the night. They don't know when he'll come, and they have to have their lamps ready so they can light the path and accompany him back to the bride's house. Now, what it means is there were 10 of these ladies. 5 of them took extra oil besides the oil that was in their lamps, and 5 of them didn't. They just had the oil that was in their lamps and didn't have any extra oil. Now, the point here is that those who didn't take extra oil were assuming the bridegroom was coming soon enough that they wouldn't run out of oil, and therefore they were not prepared for a delay, whereas the ones who took extra oil were there just in case the bridegroom doesn't come all that soon and they run out of oil. They want to make sure that they still had enough oil whenever he did arrive. And so they were prepared for a delay if that would happen, and therefore they were prepared for a longer wait. And I think that that was what Jesus is teaching there. Now, when the 5 virgins who lacked extra oil awoke and found their lamps had burned out and they didn't have extra oil, they came to the others and said, "Give us some of your oil." Well, those women who had extra oil, they didn't have enough to share, and they had an obligation to burn that oil in their lamps. The oil wasn't something they were using for their own pleasure. It was their obligation to light the way for the bridegroom when he comes. So their oil was not really theirs to give away. When Jesus says give to everyone who asks you, it doesn't mean give away stuff that you actually have other obligations for. Like if you're on your way, if you just have enough money to pay your electric bill and it's due today, and you're walking down to the electric company with the money in your hand, and a beggar says, "Hey, could you give me some money?" Well, you can't give him the money that you already owe to someone else. That money's not yours. And likewise, the oil that the virgins had was not really theirs. It was part of their duty to burn their lamps for the bridegroom, and so they had to have that oil for that. They didn't have enough for 10 lamps. The 5 virgins had brought enough for their own, but not for double that amount. So, in other words, when Jesus says give to everyone who asks you, it doesn't mean give them even things that already have other, that are already committed to other purposes. It means, you know, that you should share with people the things you have. But a lot of the things you have are not really yours to give away because they're already committed, they're already owed somewhere else. For example, if you had to buy groceries for your children, which is your obligation, and someone else asked you to give your grocery money to some cause that they wanted you to invest in, well, you can't do that because you have an obligation to your children at first. I mean, there is such thing as elective money that you can give away, but there is also money that's not elective. It's money that's already devoted to something else, something important. Take, for example, people who feel they should tithe. Well, then 10% of their money belongs to God, as far as they're concerned. They can't use that for something other than God, presumably. And likewise, money that's devoted to supporting your family or for paying bills that you owe, that money has to go there first. And you know, if that means you don't have as much to give to a beggar, well, that's too bad. Too bad you don't have enough to do both. But if you don't, you have to meet your obligations first.
Mm-hmm.
The 10 virgins had an obligation to have oil in their lamps for the bridegroom's sake.
I'd never heard that was an obligation. I thought it was something that they were just doing. I took it as sort of a salvation thing.
No, the women, the virgins were part of the marriage party. It's just like if the the maid of honor was entrusted with the ring, you know, for the wedding ceremony. And as she's walking to the wedding ceremony and someone says, "Hey, I'm really out of luck and I need some food. I know you have a ring there. Could I take that and sell it Well, you know, the maid of honor has an obligation to get that ring to the wedding. That's her obligation. She's not free to give it away. And likewise, the bridesmaids is what they were. The virgins were bridesmaids. They were functioning in the marriage ceremony to accompany the bridegroom as part of the ceremony.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I just thank you very much. I'll
All right.
talk to you again.
Okay, John. Thanks for your call.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. I mean, Joe. Sorry. That was not Joe. John. That was Joe. This is John from Denver, Colorado again. Hi, John.
Sorry about the breakup there a little while ago.
Yeah. Now you sound better now.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, but I guess my question was, even though, you know, no matter what we agree, what we, you know, think about whether it's right or wrong, in the arena of, you know, amillennialism and premillennialism and postmillennialism, it just be distinct enough, you think, to have its own category, since it's not premillennial, because in 1,000 years, there's not going to be any human life to experience it. Everybody will either be in hell or in heaven. And it's not exactly...
Well, but the question is, are they associating that 1,000 years with Revelation 20?
Yes.
Okay. Do they believe in a second coming of Christ?
Yes.
Do they place it before or after that 1,000 years?
Before the 1,000 years.
Then they are premillennial. They believe in a premillennial coming of Christ. That's what that's what premillennialism means. It means they believe in a coming of Christ before the 1,000 years.
Okay, so it doesn't matter about like the details, like whether Christ reigns on earth or whether...
Oh, no. There's all kinds of different views about that. For example, dispensationalists are premillennial, and some of the church fathers were premillennial, but they had extremely different views about the millennium. The dispensationalists think the millennium is going to be a reinstitution of the temple worship and the sacrifices and all that stuff. The early premillennialists in the early church didn't believe such things. So, I mean, it is a radically different idea of what takes place during the millennium. The question is, are they talking about Revelation 20? That's the only millennium in the Bible. The Bible doesn't mention the millennium anywhere else except in Revelation 20. And so the question is, okay, the millennium, the 1,000 years in Revelation 20, do they place the coming of Christ before it or after it? If they place the coming of Christ before it, then they're premillennial. If they place it after it, they're postmillennial.
All righty. Thank you very much for the info, Stephen, for clearing that up.
Okay, John.
All right. Appreciate your info. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, sure. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. For the first time in the hour, we have our lines open, all of them. So if you'd like to get through, the first one to call can get on the air. We don't have very much time left, so you'd have to do it now. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I have an announcement to make for those in the Seattle area, and that is that on Thursday nights, and today is Thursday, so that's tonight, on Thursday nights I'm teaching a series on the Kingdom of God in Monroe, Washington. Not all that far, about an hour from Seattle, and closer still to many of our listeners. And if you're interested in coming to that gathering, that's tonight, and it's held at a Youth with a Mission base in Monroe, or outside, it's not in Monroe, it's outside Monroe, and you can find the address and directions at our website. Now, so I realize some people don't have computers, so if you're interested in coming to that, that's at 7 o'clock tonight. I can give you the address, and if you have some other way of, you know, using a GPS or something to find it, fine. It's not the easiest thing to find, but it's not impossible either. The YWAM base is on Bolinbaugh Hill Road, technically in Monroe, although it's about 5 miles out of town. The address is 10211. That's 10211. 10211. Bolinbaugh Hill. That's Bolenbaugh. Bolinbaugh Hill Road. And that's in Monroe. The zip code is 98272, if you're using a GPS, 98272. You can get directions to the place from the website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. The meeting is tonight at 7, and I have been happily meeting some of our listeners there week after week. I'd be glad to meet you if you're in the area and want to come by. Let's talk to Jason from Monterey, California. Jason, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
All right, thanks.
Since you're on the subject, I just had a quick question about preterism.
Yeah.
Can you tell me why? I've heard it said that they believe that Jesus already, we're already in the thousand-year millennium.
Well, that's a view of amillennialism. That's not necessarily distinctively preterist. Okay, preterism believes that Revelation and the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 are essentially fulfilled in AD 70. But amillennialism is a different issue. Amillennialism is the view that the millennium in Revelation 20 is a symbolic designation for the age of the church. The millennium begins with Satan being bound for 1,000 years and then loosed at the end of the 1,000 years to stage one final brief rebellion, after which he is thrown into the lake of fire. And there's a judgment day and a resurrection at the end of that time. Amillennialism believes that the binding of Satan at the beginning of the 1,000 years is symbolic for what Christ accomplished at the cross and his destruction of the power of Satan through the cross. They believe the 1,000 years represents the whole age of the church, however long that may be. 1,000 years would not be a statistic or an actual number, but rather just means a long time. And at the end of that time, Satan being loosed for a little while would speak of a yet future general rebellion against God worldwide, which would be followed by the second coming of Christ. So at the end of the 1,000 years, when fire comes down from heaven and consumes the wicked in Revelation 20, verse 9, they would take that to be the second coming of Christ, because Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 1, and verse 8, that Jesus will come in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and who do not obey our Lord Jesus Christ. So the amillennial position is that the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 is symbolic for the whole period of time between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. And that was the view, that's the view that was held by most Christians throughout history.
Thank you very much. I just have one more question for you.
Okay.
Should I be able to stream your programs through the iPod? If I get an iPhone, will I be able to get your cast or podcast through that system?
Yes. Well, I believe so. I've never listened to podcasts of any kind, but I know that our program is available on podcasts. So as far as I know, it's available for iPhone.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Good talking to you, Jason.
Good day now.
Bye now. All right. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. This is a daily program. If it's new to you, you might want it to become a regular habit, unless you don't like it, in which case you might want to take note not to listen to this station at this time, Monday through Friday, from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. And that's Pacific time. Some of our listeners are in other time zones. And the program is an open forum, and it's live daily, so that you can call in with whatever questions you have about the Bible, and we can discuss them together. Or you can call and express disagreements with the host, which I always enjoy. Callers doing that as well. Well, I don't always enjoy them doing it. Sometimes they don't do it in a very friendly way, but most of the time I enjoy it. And we are a program that's been on the air daily for about over 12 years. And we do this by paying for time on the radio. We buy the time. We don't sell anything. You'll find our website has nothing for sale, but lots of stuff for free. And we don't have commercial breaks in the program. We don't have sponsors or anything like that. This is not a commercial venture. It's a ministry. And as such, we depend on God to provide the money we pay to the radio stations and to the 800-number phone company. That money usually comes through listeners. And if you'd like to help us pay those bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. The website I mentioned is thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Check that out, and I hope you'll check us out again tomorrow so we can continue this discussion. God bless.